I'd like to, first of all, welcome the members of the committee and welcome to those of you in the audience. We are going to begin today with a work session on House Bill 2450. Jim, would you like to read a staff summary?
Thank you, Chair. Chair and Committee, House Bill 2450 allows a parent receiving temporary assistance for needy families to attend post-secondary institution full-time as an allowable work activity, stipulates requirements on participants, and limits their participation to 1% of households receiving assistance. We also have two amendments, -6 and -8, to consider today.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kafouri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Kafouri, State Representative, District 43. First of all, I would like to thank the Chair very much for all of his indulgences. We've been around and around and around on this bill, which there is no opposition to and yet seems to throw up hurdles in our every step. However, I think we've come up with the perfect solution. If you will look at the -8 amendments, the -8 amendments basically say that the program will not go forward if the state of Oregon does not have the necessary waivers from the Department of Health and Human Services. And I think this allays any concerns that legislative fiscal and the department have about any cost that may be incurred. And as a result of passing this -8 amendment, there will be no fiscal, and therefore the bill will not have to go to the Ways and Means Committee if it is the chair's choice. So I think that I haven't heard any opposition to the bill. I haven't heard any opposition to the -8 amendments, and I feel confident that these will work as drafted.
Okay, any questions? And we also have a -6. Jim, who is that?
Representative Farr.
Okay. Representative Farr, would you like to discuss the -6 amendments?
I'd love to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No.
The -6 amendments, we already spoke about at a previous meeting. What it essentially does is it allows for education opportunities in institutions other than two-year or four-year regularly certified colleges, such as it allows for people to go to, for instance, a trade school of some kind, or perhaps a for-profit university of some kind. And that's about it. A lot of lines there, but it's all just doing the same thing.
Okay. Representative Farr, I do have a question. Do you see the amendment, -6, mm-hmm. which you've just discussed, being kind of a precedent for, say, other issues to include these sorts of maybe institutions for profit? If we were talking about, say, opportunity grants, do you see any relationship between this and that?
I see this being quite a bit different to the opportunity grant, because this doesn't really dilute any existing funds, whereas the opportunity grant will be a completely separate conversation because of the funding mechanism involved.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hobson, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the -6 amendments to House Bill 2450, please.
Representative Hobson moves the -6 amendments to House Bill 2450. Any discussion? Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the clarification that you just made and that Representative Farr gave us. And with that clarification, I support these amendments.
Oh, thank you. Okay, any objections? Hearing none, then, -6 is added to the bill. Representative Hobson?
Mr. Chair, I move the -8 amendments to House Bill 2450, please.
Thank you. Representative Hobson has moved the -8 amendments to House Bill 2450. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2450 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
And you have another statement about the Ways and Means?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like us to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. So Representative Hobson moves House Bill 2450 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and this includes the referral to the Ways and Means Committee to be rescinded. Discussion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
I hope that in 2 years we can come back and expand this program. It's a wonderful start. Thank you for bringing it to us, Representative Shapori.
Yes, and I would say from the perspective of the chair, it has been a bill that's been somewhat difficult, especially with no opposition. But no one ever said life had to be easy. And I'm hoping that we can make this work, turn a negative into a tremendous positive here. And so with that having been said, Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received a constitutional majority, House Bill 2450 as amended is declared passed. We need a carrier.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much, Representative. Representative Vodkin will carry House Bill 2450. Excuse me. Representative Kefouri, would you like to carry the bill?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. We'll have Representative Kefouri carry the bill. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2807. Jim, is your staff summary for us, please?
Yes, sir. House Bill 2807. Forms Eastern Oregon Collaborative Colleges Center for the purpose of increasing access to post-secondary education for students in Eastern Oregon. Appropriates money from the general fund to Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development for Eastern Oregon Collaborative College Center. There are no amendments and has a referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Representative Farr, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move to move measure 2807 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Farr moves that we pass House Bill 2807 and move it to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I applaud the work that this consortium is doing to coordinate its efforts and to increase access to students in the eastern part of our state. And I would support a recommendation to move it to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation as to passage. But I can't support a due pass recommendation because I don't have, and we don't have in front of this committee, a record that tells us the consequences in the higher ed budget of supporting this compared with other programs in the higher ed budget. If the Ways and Means Committee took our recommendation as is, I'd like to know what falls off the bottom of the list before I can support recommending that this particular bill be passed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lockin.
I would echo the sentiment that this is just an extraordinary program and is very worthy of being funded in virtually any time except the one that we're living in right now, where even $2.5 million is something that we may not have in July or August. And for that reason, even though I think it's an extraordinary program, I also would not be able to support passage of the bill at this time.
Thank you. Representative Hobson?
Ditto.
As you already, could you explain the meaning of that, please?
Mr. Chair, I have already explained it to you to the sponsor of the bill. I see it's a wonderful program, but there isn't any money, and I'm not willing to take 2.5 from anything else.
Representative Farr, you've heard some comments. Would you consider withdrawing your motion, or would you want to go ahead?
At your pleasure, Chair.
I would ask you to withdraw your motion, if you would. And recommend or make a motion that we move it to the Ways and Means with a no recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion. And I move that we pass it to Ways and Means with no recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Farr withdraws his original motion and moves that we pass 2807 to the Ways and Means Committee with a no recommendation. Discussion.
That is to say without a recommendation.
Yes, without a recommendation, yes.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
And Representative Farr, thank you. That's my discussion.
Okay. Okay, Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Having received a constitutional majority, House Bill 2807 passes to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2817. No, excuse me. 2817, I apologize. 2817 is being delayed. We discovered, without thinking too much about it, that it's spring vacation. And those who are interested in testifying in favor, many of those, are not available. So we're going to bring this back at some point after spring vacation.
April 7th.
April 7th, to be specific. So I apologize for not announcing that at the beginning of the meeting. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3044. Jim?
Thank you, sir. House Bill 3044 allows school districts to seek payment of amount owed by a student from parent or guardian of the student through collections unit in the Department of Revenue. Sets a minimum amount owed for collection by this means.
Okay, thank you. Steve Little, please. Matt Marquis and John Bollinger. We could call all three of you up.
Good afternoon, Chair Backlund and members of the committee. My name is Steve Little with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And as the bill is currently drafted, we would be the agency that would be assisting in the collection of these amounts that are due on the bill here before you today. And the department neither supports nor opposes this bill. Our position has long been that we provide the services that the legislature wants us to. However, I should point out that at least at this point, for the most part, those things that the legislature has been asking us to do have been in support of state agencies rather than in local jurisdictions. Now, last session there was a change to that slightly, in that we are now providing service to collect debts owed county sheriffs for persons who were incarcerated. It's a very small piece. However, if the legislature wishes us to do that, we are certainly happy to provide that service. It is well within the types of items that we do collect for. And I would like to provide a little bit of background information for the other agency accounts unit that we're talking about here today. It was established in the early 1970s, as I said, to provide service for collection to other state agencies. And we support 150 state agencies and the district and circuit courts. And this biennium will collect about $60 million in debt for those agencies. Historically, the growth of the collections of that unit has increased by 10 to 20% per biennium. So it is growing fairly well. And our fees charged range from roughly 8 to 9% of the amount that's collected. We are authorized under ORS 293-250 to provide the service to other agencies, and this bill would also specify to the school districts as well. And we have been unable at this point to provide a fiscal impact for this bill. it's a little up in the air as to how many accounts would be provided, and I understand that there are some amendments that are going to be possibly worked on in this bill as well that would change that. I can give you roughly an idea that for any 5,000 accounts that are sent to the department a year by an agency, we have to add about a revenue agent and about a sixth of an FTE of support services for that revenue agent. So that is roughly the direction we'll be going once we have better numbers.
Steve, and, did you say yeah. for every $5,000?
Every 5,000 accounts.
Accounts, okay.
Yeah. And so, and that would probably be regardless of how big the accounts are, because it takes as much time to collect $100 as it does $1,000, really, in terms of a phone call and the like. And with that, we would certainly be willing to work with the group as we go through the amendments and put that fiscal impact together whenever we can. It is other fund limitation, expenditure limitation increase, and position authority. It's not general fund monies we'd be discussing here. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Okay. John, why don't you go next, if you would. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me clarify. You mentioned that it would cost money from other fund allocation, but then also in your text you indicate that it is self-funding in that you take a percentage of the amount collected. Is that amount not enough to really pay the cost?
No, that is what we're talking about. The other funds limitation means that somebody else can give us money and we can spend it.
Got it.
And not the general fund.
Okay, John.
Committee Chairman Backlund and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to appear here today. This is a topic that I testified on 2 years ago, I believe, and at that time the bill died for lack of support or some problems that were real or perceived with this issue. What I've given you or provided is a chart that I hope it's not too confusing. I'll lead you through this, but basically this was something that was very hurriedly done. We do not have or have not had the urgent need to compile this data in a real systematic manner because we haven't had the leverage to collect these fees in the past. And so I've looked at two or three sources from our librarians on the last day of school before break to the bookkeeper to provide some data for me. And basically the first table or the first boxed area shows the billed textbooks that we have at McNary High School, not broken down in terms of a specific dollar amount per class, but graduating year on the left, 03, 04, 05, and 06, which would be in descending order from this year's seniors, juniors, sophomores, and freshmen. The total number of students who owe over $150 just in textbooks, in non-return textbooks. There are three students between $100 and $150, 10 students, between $50 and $100, 21 students, and between $1 and $50, 58 students. The total amount of dollars owed just on textbooks by this year's seniors at McNary High School is $4,979.60. I'm not going to read every bit of data on that, but that gives you an idea of how I compiled this. It's interesting to note that I don't know that you would assume that as students are in high school longer, their debt that's incurred would grow. I don't know if this is an anomaly, but our junior class seems to be a little bit more irresponsible. They have $6,300 in debt. And the freshman class of 06, with three more years to go, obviously has more than one-fourth that the senior class has. So there's a total, if we can call this an encumbered amount or a total amount that's owed on textbooks alone, is $18,036.32. This is just at our high school. I don't believe that our high school is that much different than any other high school in Salem or within the state. If we go to the next table down, which is table two, this is broken down on just the senior class
And this was the information that was provided to me by our librarians who did a little bit of research with this. The total amount that is owed for over $150 is a total of $601 and change. Between $100 and $150 is $1,254. $50 to $100 and $1 to $50, a total amount of $49.79, which is the amount that's shown above. It's a similar breakdown for the other classes proportionally, and I realize that it would be cost efficient to go after the larger dollar amounts or the larger violators of the policy and so forth, and not so cost effective to go after smaller amounts. But if you'd note, if this could be lowered to $100, you would go just with this one particular class from an amount of $601 potentially recovered to $1,800, more than a tripling of the amount of monies that could be recovered by our school. This is something that seems like a small change item. I know in the large scale of things, when you look at Salem-Keizer's budget or if you look at the entire state's educational budget, but on a local level, when I'm dealing with a reality of an English teacher that comes to me and says, we just got two students that moved into our class and we have no textbooks, and I'm on the telephone trying to go back one or two or three years to students who have withdrawn from McNary High School and make telephone calls and offer to come and pick up books and knock on people's doors, this is something that I feel that I really could use some help with some leverage. Now, there's one other aspect of this that I'd like to you to include expanding also, and this is box number three. The two boxes at the top deal entirely with textbooks. The third box deals with all fees owed by McNary High School students. That could be lab fees, those could be PE uniforms, those could be athletic uniforms, which are a real interesting case. People oftentimes like to keep a uniform despite the best efforts of coaches to get every uniform back, sort of a souvenir, memorabilia, and so forth. If you have 15 people on a basketball team and if two uniforms disappear, you don't just go buy two new uniforms that match those. Virtually the entire set of uniforms is non-functional. This is an expanded amount if we look at the class of 03, there are eight students who owe a total of between $100 and $150, a total of $1,023. There are nine students who owe over $150, $1,775. So between over $100, we have a total of $2,798. Now, if you look at the total in the lower right-hand corner of that box of $14,942, why is this amount less if this includes all fees other than textbooks? Why is that amount less than the one on box number one of $18,000? It's because if you'll note that the top box includes a breakdown all the way down to $1 between $1 and $50. And the textbook and other fees only goes to the down to the $100 amount. As I said, we are looking for leverage to recover the texts. Given the choice of textbooks, if you've not purchased any recently, if you don't have sons and daughters in college, they're not $20 texts anymore. They're, for the most part, history and science and math books are over $50. We have advanced placement calculus books that are $80 a piece. I would much rather have the textbook back rather than trying to buy a textbook, even a used textbook from Northwest Textbook or some other depository, that's a 4 or 5 year old textbook, knowing that we may only use that book for a couple more years and have to go through an adoption. So we would much rather get the books back. And as I said, we're looking for some way to get books, uniforms, and so forth back. So I would entertain any questions.
John, you didn't mention at the very bottom of your chart,
The
amount outstanding is now really moving up there in terms of amount.
I'm sorry, and this is from the printout that I have that's made available to us on a monthly basis. We have a total of 460 students, and it's interesting to note a pattern of students as someone who's been in a school for quite a while, but you start to see name familiarity, and it's a matter of accountability. And someone had mentioned in a past the past hearing that I was here, this could place a hardship on needy families. And someone who was on the committee last time made a very, very appropriate statement. And they said, you know, this comes down to a matter of responsibility. And you can teach responsibility to all specters or all a full range of economic backgrounds, not only needy students, but affluent students. And if we look at a total of 460 students, and we have a student body of 1,850 at this time, 1,855, those 460 students owe a total of 2,589 individually billed items. Those are not all from McNary High School. Some of those have followed them all the way from elementary school, and I'm sure they'd love to have the books back, middle school, and so forth. And so we're looking at approximately one-fourth of our students that we need some a little bit of persuasive leverage with. And the total dollar amount that we have at this point that's outstanding at McNary High School as of March 3rd, I believe it was, is slightly over $30,000. And these are largely uncollectible fees. We do have a little bit of an incentive for students to pay, but that comes at the end of their senior year. And that's if they do need a transcript to go on. If they don't need a transcript, we have people who not only do not pick up their final grades, but they don't pick up diplomas. We still have diplomas in the vault.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, if I might. I appreciate the fact I, too, have been in the phone call business trying to collect money on things such as this. My question to you is, if you and I, knowing the people involved, recognizing the names, knowing where the contacts are relatively unable to make these collections, why and how would we think the Department of Revenue and or a collection agency would have a better chance of doing that?
I might defer that to someone from a state agency.
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, we do have a number of fairly significant tools. Unfortunately, you might have to step to the point of garnishment of wages or activities like that, or taking bank accounts in order to get the money, but we do have those capabilities.
I have one additional thought, and that's that oftentimes these are students that the question will come to me, why don't you get the books back before these students withdraw from school? And in some cases, they become what we call a 10-day drop. They do not appear at school. We haven't heard any word. We try to make contact. We can't contact them. After 10 days, we're bound by law to withdraw them from school so that we don't continue to receive state basic school support. They're people that, as far as we know, they've dropped off the face of our computer screen. And people within the state agencies, the revenue department, and so forth, would have better success in locating these folks than us.
Thank you. And I might add, while we're on this topic at this moment, there are amendments coming. Steve mentioned that he'd heard amendments are coming. They provide quite a bit of flexibility, and I'm sorry that they're not available for this hearing, but I guess my interest was to bring this to our attention. And particularly in a time such as now where funding is really critical, it seems that this particular bill at this time is an important bill to discuss. I think we need to raise the issue, and maybe with the amendments we'll want to pursue it further. Today's a public hearing only. I would like to speak to this too as a former teacher. By the way, John and I met in January of 1969, so it's not like we don't know each other. As a teacher, you're given you get some new books every once in a while. It's pretty exciting, and so you have a set of textbooks. Maybe you have 150 of them. We take a great effort in pointing out how to care for the books. Don't throw them in the bottom of a locker. We give them book covers, and we make sure they have tape, and they protect these things. High school books in particular are pretty tough. The book bindings are tough. They have a really good glue, much better than a college level textbook, actually. But as John said, they're very, very expensive. And if I bought new advanced placement American history books, these are college level textbooks, they are spending. And so at the end of the year, you take in, or at the end of the semester, actually, and then you reissue. You take in your books, and it's very embarrassing and it's very frustrating when you lose a number of books because we have not been able to collect them. And I always had this sense of frustration. It was shared by every teacher I ever talked to. It was embarrassing to the teacher. It just was not a good situation, and I know we're interested in responsibility and accountability. And that's what brought us to the bill 2 years ago. It was in judiciary 2 years ago, and now we're back again in a different era, in a different economic climate, I think. So I thought this was an important bill for us to hear. So, yes, Representative Nolan?
Mr. Chair, I had a question. John, do you know roughly what proportion of these 460 students are currently enrolled, as compared with what proportion of them are fit into the 10-day drop or transferred student category?
I don't have that information right now.
Could, Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Could you hazard a guess? Are we talking 400 of these folks have left the system, or are we talking that 420 of them are still around?
I think probably 75% of them are still around.
Okay.
You know, one of the issues that we have, too, is as I look at the charges that are here, I'll have some students who are charged two and three times for the same book, different number. And so the thought is, student loses a math book. And the student said, goes to the teacher, I lost my math book. We don't check textbooks out to the teachers anymore. We check them out through, they're barcoded, and they're checked out to the library. They're scanned back in. So that the student that says, I turned in a textbook, well, you may have, but it's not your textbook. Go find yours. But when a student comes to a teacher and says, I lost my textbook, it's pretty tough to succeed in a math class without a textbook to do homework. And so we're in a real catch-22. Do we say to the student, all right, you can't check out another book until you pay for the first one, and if that first book comes back, then we'll reimburse your money? Or do we say, no, you go ahead and check out another textbook, but now you're responsible for both textbooks? And honestly, I do have students who have up to three textbooks that they've checked out for the same class. We want to see students succeed. We don't want to throw this as an impediment in their way. But again, it becomes pretty frustrating with students who are not only irresponsible with one textbook, but subsequent books given to them.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question of you, Mr. Little. I appreciate the fact that garnishment works in some cases, but by far the majority of these students will not have any pay coming in. What are some of the other methods you'll use, particularly after you've heard this discourse, to collect not only the books, but from the athletes who have failed to turn in their jerseys and such?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, I think what the bill requires is that, certainly to send an account to us, it has to be liquidated in delinquent form, meaning it has to be turned to dollars, and thus be collectible. And so we would send a letter out, first attempt, and we would make a phone call. I mean, it's a progressive group of steps, and I believe that we would be collecting against the parent or guardian and not the student themselves, that the debt is transferred to their responsible person, if you will.
Follow up. Do you feel confident that since the schools have been, at least when I was in that position, totally ineffective and unable to make these collections, you think you will be more able to do that?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, we will certainly give it every effort. We do provide service to other agencies who have collection staff because we have more data and more resources and tools. We do have more capability of making the collection.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something was sparked in my mind by Representative Hobson's question or statement about, you know, making the phone calls to folks to try to get books back. I mean, what are the conventional methods that you have available to you to try to do that, Mr. Chair?
Perhaps I could defer that to Mr. Bollinger.
Could you repeat the question?
What are the conventional methods available to individual schools to what are the steps you have to take to try to get your property back?
Representative Dalton, when or Dalton, when a teacher or a librarian comes to me and says that Vic Backlund has dropped from McNary High School and we have a listing of textbooks which are missing, myself as a principal or one of my assistant principals, and normally myself, will get on the phone and call and say, you still have these textbooks out. I guess a first step that I skipped over is obviously check the locker. Try as we might, it's pretty hard to convince students that this is yours and a locker partner's locker. You're not to share with other folks. I don't know how students can, they can't remember mathematic equations, but they can remember the locations of 15 lockers and the combination of each one, and they mix and match lockers, and they go back, oh, I have math class next period, go grab a math book, and they're off. And a math book that belongs to Vic Backlund may live in 15 lockers during the course of a year. So the first thing that we'll do is we check an individual locker that belonged to that student. We do have locker clean out at the semester break, in which case every textbook, if it's a year-long class, they have to be checked into the teacher. If they're a semester-long class, they have to be checked into the library. So we do have an accounting for the books that have come back and are missing. The student checks out of school. The first thing that we might do is check with the library to see if that book has been turned in. If it's not there, get on the phone. If a student has stopped coming to school, invariably or oftentimes, all too often, it's not that they're just staying home. The family has moved somewhere else. Oftentimes, without a forwarding address, we get a request for records from another school district, and there isn't a lot of incentive for another school district if that student moves to Heppner, as an example, for Heppner to not check out textbooks until they make good on McNary High School's textbooks. So there just isn't that sort of spirit of cooperation, and I'm not sure that there should be. We're not looking to deny a student their education.
Maybe I can clarify my question. I guess in my mind there are two sorts of students that you're having issues with getting your textbooks back. The sort that leaves the school for good and you're unable to make contact or they're unwilling to return the property. And then you have another set of students who are the students that continue on in the school and have problems time and time again but are unwilling to rectify the problem. And so I understand very clearly about the students that are leaving the school, essentially never to be heard from again. But for the group of students that remain in the school, that you remain in a position where you have control over them, I mean, are you able to take, you know, positive steps like withholding grades or threatening, you know, failure or all sorts of, you know, measures that you can take to get those students to turn books in? And is it as an acute of a problem for students who stay in school versus the ones that drop out?
Well, Representative Dalton, we do have, as I said, an estimation that about 75% of those students are probably still in school. We withhold progress, forward progress reports, which are every 6 weeks. The semester grades are withheld. That's the only leverage, basically, that we have until graduation time. And basically, we do not prevent them from walking at graduation, but we just withhold the diploma. So we do withhold the semester credit reports, the transcript, and the diploma. And that's the only leverage that we have.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
And so it doesn't sound like that is working all that well.
It's not working at this time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Taking on to Representative Delta, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why don't you keep them from walking?
From walking at graduation. That's in our particular district, that's a district policy. That's a school district policy. They have basically they have earned the right to walk at graduation. They have accumulated the credits. The financial responsibility is still there for the textbooks, fines, fees, et cetera, et cetera. And so the diploma itself is not awarded, is not given to the students. That's a district policy. I don't know, again, what the policy is around the state. I wish there were more folks that that thought this is a bigger problem, and maybe it isn't.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question. So essentially, or point, so essentially you've run out of leverage, and this bill would create a new mechanism for leverage.
That's my hope and thought.
Great. Thank you.
I would add, too, committee, a thought to kind of add to this sense of urgency, I will put it in that term. You know, we have 198 school districts in our state. We surely have more high schools than that. We have many, many middle schools. And so if we look at McNary High School, which is fairly representative of a large high school, 1,850 kids, and it's $30,000, Salem alone now has six high schools, and one of them is new, so we wouldn't have statistical looks there. But we have four other high schools that have been around a long time, and if we were to do some simple math in Salem-Keizer alone, six times 30, and that's in 1 year. That's $180,000 in 1 year. In a biennium, we're looking now at a large amount of money. We take the whole state and project, we're looking at a great amount of money here. And it seems that it's money wasted and very frustrating to everyone who has any interest at all in education.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association and Association of Private Collection Agencies. While we're neutral on the concept of this bill, we want to make sure that the bill in no way prevents a school district from using a private collection agency. The way the bill is drafted now, it may require that an account be turned over to the Department of Revenue for up to a year prior to going to a private collection agency. I think the amendments will probably take care of that problem. But there are currently some school districts in our state that are using a private collection agency, and we just don't want any prevention of that from happening, I guess. A couple other comments. There is a bill, House Bill 2055, which has already passed the House and is currently out of committee in the Senate on the way to the floor of the Senate, which would allow a local government or a state government, such as a school district, to add the collection fee to these accounts when it gets turned over to a private collection agency, so that the school district would then be made whole rather than somebody taking a commission off of it. And I would be in favor, as Mr. Bolander said, is including all fees in this. I know that there are a lot of school districts out there that rent their gyms out. Sometimes they don't get paid for that. Those fees tend to be a little higher than just a textbook. And while some of these textbooks may seem small, it's important to remember that a lot of families that may owe $50 to McNary High School may also owe a couple hundred dollars to JCPenney's and maybe another $500 to Meyer and Frank. And when these accounts get turned over to a private collection agency, you look at the debt as a whole rather than just as the $50 to McNary High School. And so there's more incentive, I guess, to go after that particular debtor to collect those funds. Just a few comments, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bakken.
I just wanted you to clarify the last point that you made. Were you implying that with kids or with families that may owe money to the district, that in some way the district be allowed to consolidate all of their debt to the collection agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bakken, I'm not sure I quite understand your question, but I can tell you that when a collection agency has one account on a debtor, that oftentimes that debtor has another account within the same collection agency from another creditor.
I understand.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nolan.
That testimony actually raised a question, and I would address it to, McNary High School. Is it your intention through this bill to in any way change the ranking of debt? Does the school district go to the front of the line by virtue of the Department of Revenue being the collector? Say, for example,
I'm getting blank faces here. Say we have a student who has lost two textbooks and owes money on a new stereo system and has a car that they're paying on, and a private collection agency is collecting on one, and the school district refers the school textbook debt to the Department of Revenue. Does that in any way change the priority of that debt, and does the school district get first dibs?
Chair Backlund, Representative Nolan, we establish by rule the priority of orders. Like when we collect something, the general fund gets first monies, and then other programs that we administer, and it goes down. And I honestly can't say what the priority of this would be. I think it's fairly low on the list. And probably then it's in a first in, first out sort of situation. So no, it wouldn't necessarily take it to the top of the list.
A follow-up.
Because
I'm not sure I asked the question that I intended to ask. If I have a student who owes $50 on textbooks and $100 on some other debt, and there is only $75 worth of assets to be had, is it proportionally shared by the creditors, or do we pay $50 for the textbook and the stereo seller only gets $25?
Chair Backlund, Representative Nolan, are we talking about like in a garnishment action if we...
Right.
Okay. Well, what that would be then is...
And does this bill change that is all I care about?
No, it should not change that process. It would be first in, first out.
Okay.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Marquis. Is there a cost associated? Is there a cost associated with a collection action to the school district if they're trying to collect on, say, somebody who didn't pay for the rental of a gym? Like, I think you made that example. Or does the collection agency just take that and build the cost in ahead of time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, say that McNary High School rented their gym out to some activity. It cost $5,000. That never got paid. It get turned over to a private collection agency. The collection agency gets would charge a contingency fee. Maybe that is 10-15%, whatever the case may be. And then as that debt gets collected, the collection agency would take their fee out of the collections. Now, assuming that House Bill 2055, and I guess you can't assume anything, but it's going through the process at this point, when an account like that got turned over to a private collection agency, the school district, prior to assigning it to the private collection agency, could add the collection agency's fee to the debt so that the entire $5,000 in that example would be reimbursed to the school district, and the private collection agency would then take their fee on top of that. But it would all be paid from the person that owed the money rather than from the school district.
Follow-up. So there's no separate fee to the school itself. So it seems like it's a pretty clean transaction. The school doesn't have any additional cost. If you're able to collect, you get your fee. But what happens if you don't collect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, if we don't collect, then we wouldn't get paid. And these rates, I mean, when you bid something like this, you factor into the equation that not everything is going to be collectible, and that's how you determine what your rate would be. So if you don't collect, you wouldn't get paid.
Thank you.
One more.
Yes, Representative Avakian. Mm-hmm.
We're talking both about a collections action, and then we've also talked about garnishment. And would the school district need to obtain a judgment in order to do the garnishment like anyone else, or does the Department of Revenue have the authority to levy a garnishment without a judgment?
Chair Backlund, Representative Avakian, it would have to become a liquidated debt, so they would in some form have to provide an administrative appeal process or something to reduce it to a liquid debt. Now, whether they would have to actually get a judgment from a court, I don't know how that would work.
I would.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, in the situation of a private collection agency, most likely the school district would turn the account over to a private collection agency pre-judgment form, and if necessary, then the private collection agency, in collaboration with the school district, could sue on the account, get the judgment, and then could issue the garnishment. But no garnishment in that situation could ever be issued prior to a judgment.
And existing law would allow them to claim whatever costs or fees that the state incurred as part of that process in the collection action, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ivakian, yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much for
Representative Backlund. I have one concluding comment. First of all, I apologize for not following the strict rules of protocol in addressing folks. This is something that, again, I don't do on a daily basis. I'm a guy who deals with parents, and I deal with kids. I guess in some cases I could be kind of like Bob Barker and let's make a deal. With students who owe a large amount of money, I have the ability to sort of act as a judge. If you bring back these books, we can wipe the slate clean on the remaining amount. And sometimes they'll take the bait and sometimes not. And basically, I guess I'm gambling on a quirk of human nature that if something comes in the mail in addition to the notice that you are not getting your semester grades, but your name may be forwarded to a collection agency, I'm gambling that we'll get a larger response than we otherwise would. This, again, it's not going to be my problem in about 4.5 months. It'll be the succeeding principal at McNary High School, but this is something that I feel is something that's long overdue. We just have cultivated the attitude that, oh well, if I don't get it back, I don't get it back, and we need some help with that. So I thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
I will comment, Mr. Chair, that we are all parents and kids.
Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3044, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3103. Jim, do you have a staff summary for us?
Yes, sir. House Bill 3103 creates a task force on school consolidation, directs task force to study and make recommendations to the 2005 Legislative Assembly about school consolidation.
Thank you very much. Representative Hobson, do you want to give us some background and introduce the bill? And, yeah, that's fine. You can go here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would invite the colleagues of mine who know more about it than I do, being so much older than I am, to come to the dais and help us with this. There are two bills. Come on, you know who I was talking about. I should probably be similar. In the interest of trying to find ways to better fund our schools and to address some of the issues that we have, several people in the body suggested taking a look at the reorganization of the schools. And in addition to that, there are a couple of bills floating over on the Senate side that either add districts to the 198 we currently have, or demand consolidation of a couple of districts, or one bill in particular suggests that we have one school district per county, which would be reorganizing them into 36 or 37 school districts. With that preface, I think you can see there are a number of options out there, and Ozzie will address some of that, and we have talked, those of us who are interested in it, in great detail about the fact that there certainly are some financial concerns, and we're definitely not oblivious to the emotional and the concerns that individual communities have in this regard. On the other hand, the purpose of a task force is to take into consideration all of those issues and to see if there are some just outcomes. And I'll let Ozzie speak to the two bills that we actually are dealing with in this regard, because he's been in charge of the amendments and with the sponsors to try and figure out how we can meld them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, I'm Ozzie Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. There is a generally accepted view held by lots of people who don't know very much about schools and budgets and so forth, that you can find lots of ways to get more accountability, more efficiency, if you just do certain things. And one of them is you just consolidate. There's too many of them. If anybody would look at the research, you'll find there's a J-shaped curve on cost versus size. Small districts cost more and large districts cost more. So just deciding that we're going to have more efficiency, save money, because we're going to consolidate school districts is not a valid assumption to make. Now, are our districts, if you were going to organize the schools in Oregon from scratch, and it was the year 1850 or whenever we didn't have school districts, but we had all the people we have now, you'd have to have that. Would you organize them the way they are now? Probably not. But I don't think you should assume that we can reorganize our way into cost savings and more efficiencies, etc. And I'm reminded of, I met yesterday with some business people, and there was an unnamed executive from Nike shared with us, reminded us that there's an old saying in the private sector, you can't cut your way to prosperity. And then he shared with us a Nike experience of the late 90s when their industry was in difficulty. And they didn't cut costs. They poured a ton of money into marketing and got a bigger share of the high-end market. And I only share that little bit of trivia with you to bring the focus. Why would you really want to talk about consolidating school districts? You really ought to want to talk about consolidating or whatever we're doing school districts to get better programs at the best cost possible to all kids. And so I think you should look at this. But I have some ideas on how you ought to go about it. And the one point I'll make, you ought not be doing it just because you think there's a lot of money and it's going to save us from having to raise taxes or fund schools. That's not, there will be some help there, but it's not what you'll get out of it. And there are two bills that talk about, let's take a task force, take some time to look at it. And I think you should take some time to look at it seriously rather than decide that 36 districts are the right number of school districts. I don't know that you want one district in Washington County. I don't know that you don't. But I don't think anybody here in the next 90 days will know whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to have one district in Washington County and one in Multnomah, etc. So that brings you to the need for giving it some serious thought, because there probably are some things that ought to be different. And so that brings you to the task force idea. So there are two task force bills, 3103 and 3171. I've got some opinions about both of them and have a set of amendments that I've been trying to convince the authors of both that they ought to change the amendments and do one. And the things I think that ought to happen, I would encourage you to give some thought to, 3170 or 3103 is the Richard Hobson, Richard Williams bill, and my amendments, and by the way, I'm going to use 3173 rather than this bill, because this bill is, the relating clause is to relating to school district consolidation.
Ozzie, you meant House Bill 3171, didn't you?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I got my 3103 is your bill, and it relates to school district consolidation, and that's too narrow a relating clause for what I would like to get done, if you are interested. First of all, I want to do away with the word consolidation, because if the task force is about consolidation, you have the war already set up before you have your first meeting, because lots of people don't want to be consolidated. They have reasons for having their school districts, etc. And for those who've been around a little while, know that we went through unification in the early 90s, and that's not the same thing. All we did in the early 90s, when we reduced our school districts from 300 to 198, was say that every school district has to run a K-12 program. Mm-hmm. And we did that. Do we have time to do a little bit? Mm-hmm. We did that because we moved to state funding and we had to create better equity of our resources for kids. And the system we had at that time, when we had 21 union high schools, each with from 2 to 8 elementary districts that fed that high school. And if you examine the spending and resources in those inside those high school districts, in every single high school district, half of the elementary schools spent more per student than the high school spent per student. And high schools, by the very nature, are more expensive to run. We had very, very high cost, lots of resource programs in some elementary districts. And then we had other elementary, we had inequities right within the high school district, plus we had inequity of lots more money being available for elementary programs than were available for the high school. So you had to take a look at that. The other reason you had to take a look at it, and we have been supporting it since the 70s, the program variations when you had eight different elementary districts and eight different school boards making decisions about program and how they fed into one high school. And you weren't allowed to say this then, but if you talk to some of the high school people, they would tell you, we can tell which district kids came from in our high school after we gave our first round of tests their freshman year, because they came from different backgrounds, different programs. And so there was a need both economically, equity, and program-wise to create K-12 districts. And that was very contentious. We tried it for 20 years, our association did, and other associations weren't as interested in it as we were. And we never got anywhere with it. And I've testified before committees like this, in which I promoted it in the early 80s, and had a principal who was paying dues to my association come up, sit down right behind me, and says, I don't care what Ozzie says, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. That's a quote I've kept for a long time. He still paid his dues, but he informed that committee that I didn't know anything what he was talking about. And it's very, and that was just talking about elementary districts becoming part of the high school in which those high school or those kids went to. When you talk about consolidation, you talk about combining school districts, each of which have a high school, and in many cases, one of them won't when it's all done. And that means shutting down high schools in towns. And that is a very, very difficult, it's more than economics, it has to do with social fabric of our state and a variety of things. And it's happening all over our country, it's going to happen in our state, but it's not something you're going to force or make happen without careful thought and a whole lot of anxiety. And that's why I think the task force approach is a good idea, and I think you ought not talk about it as consolidation. It's reorganizing our school districts in an effort to get good programs to every kid in as efficient a way as possible. That's your objective. I also think the bill should include the ESDs, and neither bill includes the ESDs. Our ESD structure is not what you would do if you were starting from scratch. And so my amendment idea would, you would have a task force that would address the reorganization of school districts and ESDs. The other bill also has in it some stuff that I wouldn't do. It talks about targeting what you can spend on administration. Statutorily establish a percent of the budget that you can spend on administration. And I think you ought to have in the bill some reference. You ought to look at administrative and program savings that are available through the reorganization. But I don't think you, at the state level, ought to decide in the statute what percent of budgets ought to go for anything. And administration's an easy target, because you all know every place they spend too much on administration, except the organization you work in and you're the administrator. You know that you do it carefully and so forth, but it's an American way that everybody else spends too much on administration. Now, you need to pay attention to it and all that good stuff, but I don't think you statutorily ought to decide that and say that to all the school districts. School districts are different. Size makes a difference. Variety of things make a difference. And so in sum, my suggestions are that you, and by the way, I do not have Mr. Patridge's permission to change his bill as much as my amendments change it. I don't want to mislead you there. But what I'm suggesting is you take Mr. Patridge's bill, because it has a broader relating cause. You amend it so you're talking about reorganization of our school districts and ESDs. You have a little bit smaller committee. The committee I've made up in these amendments, the governor, the Senate president, the speaker, and the state superintendent each appoint three people to the commission or task force, whatever you want to call it. And the only constraints on who they appoint is that they need to recognize geographic diversity, and they need the expertise and background to make the committee function properly. The other bill names COSA and OSBA and so forth, and I don't think you need to name us to those committees. Some representatives of ours might wind up on it, but I am confident our folks would be involved in any kind of work of a task force, I think that you could do it that way and it would work. With that, I'll be quiet, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. I formerly was a school board member in School District 52. Now, School District 52 is notable to your organization because our superintendent will be replacing you, of course, when you retire, Kent Hunsaker, and our high school principal, Jim Jameson, is the chair of your board. School District 52, every year, somebody who doesn't know a darn thing talks about consolidating School District 52 with Eugene School District 4J. And the words you're saying ring very, very truly in that particular instance. We're from the same town, for the most part, Eugene, but the philosophical differences between the two school boards are so vast that it would be impossible to mesh Willamette High School with Sheldon, Churchill, North and South Eugene High Schools. It just couldn't happen. And I see that exacerbated when you're talking about smaller districts from more far-flung geographic locations trying to consolidate them. So I, like you, I'm interested in moving forward and looking at this, but I don't think we're going to find a great deal of success in merging school districts or success in finding school districts that are eligible for merger. And thank you for your testimony.
Ozzie,
Jim.
Excuse me. I was just going to ask. I know that we had a task force on looking at special education after the last session, and Representative Hobson chaired that. We included a pretty good sum of money. this I notice has no recommendation or no suggestion as to what this might cost. Do you have a guess?
Your bill doesn't have money. I think Patrick's bill says there shall be some money.
But there would inevitably
be a cost. Yes,
there'd be inevitably there would be a cost. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, one of the things I would hope would come out of it, if you really get serious, is that in the end, you would create incentives for some districts to address the issue of merging. But there are some districts that are, and this is not an order. This is a national problem. We're shrinking. By the way, in North Dakota, they estimate that there will only be 3 high schools in the western half of North Dakota after the year 2012. It's a fact. I mean, demographics, and I've got all kinds of demographic data for you on Oregon. But how do you make that work for kids? And how do you make it work for communities? And I would hope that we wind up talking about incentives for some districts to take a look at. Could we be giving our kids a better shake if we did take these steps? And some there are places where that could happen.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose piqued my interest to great levels when he suggested that when he made the comment about how you would organize a school district from scratch in 1859 or 1854. My question would be how you would organize a brand new school system from scratch in 2003. But yeah, I don't know that there's an answer to that question, but I've been sitting here for the past 10 minutes thinking about it.
Ms. Chair, Representative Dalto, my reference is to if your population is spread out the way it is now and you need to deliver services to all kids, would you structure the district organization the way they are now? And I'm suggesting you probably wouldn't.
How would you?
That's what a task force would look at, and I'm done in July, so I don't have to answer the question. Remember I said there's the J-shaped curve? There is a relationship between cost and size. But you have to pay attention to program and where people are and make some other kinds of adjustments. And what's going on right now is this siege of bills. And, you know, our bill to say we'll have 36 districts because we'd have less administration, so we'll know we'll save money. And I'm just suggesting if you're really serious about that we're not organized properly, that you wouldn't pass bills to do that. You would put a task force together and ask the task force to look at delivery of program in the most efficient way we can, given our situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ozzie.
Thank you.
No one else has signed up to testify, Representative. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I would have a question, I think, for Brian Reeder in regard to the J curve, because I think Mr. Reeder has the information on the sizes that go along with that J-shaped curve. Isn't it your information, Brian, or is it Ozzy's? I can't remember.
Chair Backlund, Representative Thompson, it is mine. Ozzy stole it from me, but it's mine. As you may recall, at the end of the 01 session, or during the 01 session...
Excuse me, Brian, you give us your name, please?
Sorry, Brian Reeder, Department of Education.
Thank you.
The department was asked to do a study looking at the effects of district size on costs of delivering services, and in that study we did that. We looked not only at district size, but also school size and how it impacts the cost of delivering services to students. And what we did find, and this is consistent with a number of other studies, there is a J-shaped curve. When you talk about district size, at very low sizes, the cost per student is very high. It comes down rapidly as district size goes up, and then starts to go back up again, but fairly slowly. And in the study we did here in Oregon, I think the minimum cost district size is on the order of 8,000 to 10,000 students, so considerably larger than many of the districts in the state, but also considerably smaller than quite a few of the districts in the state. So I think Ozzy's right. We're not, it's probably not a good idea to go into this with the notion that what you're looking for is ways to consolidate. I think you really want to look at the best way to deliver services and the best size of districts and schools to deliver services. And you know, one possible conclusion is we have some districts in Oregon that are too big, and maybe those should be split, although that has its own set of problems.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Well, very good. With that, then, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3103, and we will close the hearing.
I think we should test the Boy Scouts for their merit badge.